netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for joining us for this FX Podcast. Today we're going to continue in our series of coverage on Harry Potter, The Deathly Hallows, or 7.1 as a lot of people have been calling it. We're going to talk today with David Vickery from Double Negative. I just want to point you real quickly to a couple of the previous stories we've done on this topic. First of all, we did a podcast, the last podcast, with Framestore, talking about animating Dobby and Creature characters. And also on the homepage under the articles, you'll find a Framestore article on the Deathly Hallows animation, which I saw the film recently, and I got to say that was one of my favorite parts of the film, just this really beautiful, unusual animation style to illustrate this point in the story. So hope you'll check those other podcasts and articles out on our coverage of Harry Potter. Anyway, let's jump over now with Mike Seymour as he speaks with VFX supervisor from Double Negative, David Vickery.
These are dark times, there is no denying.
Tell me where he is.
Our world has faced no greater threat than it does today.
But you can't fight this war on your own, Mr. Potter.
Firstly, thanks for joining us. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
I guess there are many things that we could talk about, and Dean Egg's involvement with the Potter franchise extends obviously far beyond this film. But I thought if I could take a time now before the franchise runs out, I just think I've never actually had a chance to talk to you guys about, I guess, to be slightly cutesy about it, how you do the magic of actually making magic. In other words, I'd actually like to discuss, if we could, just some of the things like the apparitions and the Patronus and just how these are actually done, because it's very easy to get lost in a lot of other stuff. And they're very distinctive looks that have been developed over time, and in this film they work very, very effectively. And I just thought we'd just burrow down and get a little more detail on those sort of actual magical elements, because after all, it's a wizarding world.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. It has developed over the sort of four or five films now that we've worked on, and each director has brought their own sort of specific vision to the magic of Harry Potter, and they've brought their own spin on it. But David Yates, most recently in the last three movies, he's always wanted it to be a very visceral, very real style of magical effect. So you get this, it's evolved into this sort of quite flash, a very sharp flash and bang effect. So you very rarely see sort of long tendrils and flowing cords of magic flying around the screen, but you get this sort of almost like gun-like effect, where you get these sort of bright flashes and sort of physical explosions, like a physical practical effects element. I think the reason is because they've always wanted it to feel like it's an actual physical thing, rather than a sort of beautiful, pretty, magical spell. It's actually like a gun going off.
If I could sort of be as much of an asshole as to contradict you, but isn't that exactly the opposite of what happens with the Patronus? I mean, these are very magical, quite long screen time, and not very bang and flashy in this film.
Yeah, no, that's true. The Patronus is a sort of an exception in that it's not a spell. It's not something that's designed to attack or hurt or maim or wound or kill anybody. The Patronus is supposed to be a visual, physical thing. But what happens is a lot of the reference goes back to real things. So optical. We studied a lot of reference for just sort of optical lens effects, sort of light shows and bioluminescent underwater sea creatures. So the sort of reference that we have goes back to how we can actually try and make the magical spell take a physical, real presence in the world, to try and make it feel like a physical object rather than a sort of an illusion, as it were. It's definitely something that is lingered on, probably because it needs pictures and it needs time to tell a story. And it is certainly one of the more playful elements of the magic that David Yates and Tim have dreamt up for the more recent Potter films. It's sort of the good part of the good version of the Death Eater apparates. The sort of dark, inky black smoke is sort of the exact opposite of that, in a way.
And even the, which is great, I think, that the bad characters have them. I mean, Umbridge has a cat, which, you know, is on screen for quite a bit of time. Obviously, I assume everybody knows who's behind the one in the forest that leads to the sword. But these are on screen for a while, and they can be good and all bad characters that are producing them.
So it reflects the character of the personality of the magician or wizard or witch that's cast the spell. And I think that's one of the nice things about it, is that you get in the previous movie we've done Ron's sort of dopey Labrador that careers and charges around the room of requirements, and Luna's sort of airy fairy rabbit that bounces and prances around the rooms. And it's a story point that's designed to express the emotions of the characters. In the latest movie, we've done the Patronus that appears in the wedding attack scene when Bill and Fleur's wedding, and Kingsley Shacklebolt has sent a Patronus. And again, it was designed originally, I think, in the books, it was a panther of some description. Some sort of cat. It's a while since I've read it, but I believe it was an animal originally, and that it was a panther that stalked through the room and actually spoke the words. But for one reason or another, they changed their mind about it being an animal. I heard the stories of it being slightly awkward having an animal doing lip syncing whilst the sort of audio that Kingsley Shacklebolt had recorded was being spoken. But also, I think they just wanted to convey the sense of emergency. So it's turned into this, it's not an animal at all, it's almost like an emergency beacon.
Yeah, I was going to say beacon, yeah.
Yeah, that sort of flies into the room and slams into the ground. It's like a cannonball or a comet, and it's got much more of a sense of urgency about it. And the fact that it's not a creature allows you to concentrate more on the audio, more on the warning that it's giving, and then the sort of the distorted faces, the sort of images of terror and the collapse of the ministry that are projected from the core of it.
Yeah, it has a more utilitarian purpose than the other ones, which seem to be more emotive.
And defensive. And it's designed to warn. It's not really there for show or to sort of evoke the feelings of the character that's cast the spell at all. You're right, it's utilitarian.
He's after you, Mr. Potter.
Tell me where he is.
You really don't stand a chance.
I shot him! Help me!
Now, there are occasions where that kind of magic is, you know, still very action sequency, like the escape from the ministry at the lift. But there are other scenes where this is really played out that we can see it. And I'm wondering, is the sort of, for want of a better term, the formula for how one of these comes about, is that now refined to a point that if somebody, for some reason, in the last film wants to do one, it's just sort of not plug and play, but you know, you've got it down pat, or do they change each time? Are they scene dependent?
Yeah, it's a bit of both, really, and it always is, I suppose, a bit of both. We certainly have a library of elements that we have developed over the movies, and we draw on them, and every time we start on a new project, the first thing we want to do and the first thing Tim Burke wants to do is to, not trying to reinvent the wheel, but to take up where we left off and improve the look and improve the aesthetic that we're delivering to the client. So we do draw on a whole ream of sort of a library of effects and elements that we've got, but at the same time there's so much specific choreography for every shot, whether it's just because it's dark and it's at night and the effect needs to be the focus of the frame, or perhaps it's broad daylight and in broad daylight, a bright magical effect is difficult to sell against a bright sky. So the biggest component of the magical effect that we get in the Lovegood attack, for example, is the physical destruction, the physical tearing apart of the walls and the dust and debris that's flying around in the air. The actual magic becomes a brief, vaguely colourful flash in the air. So there needs to be a sort of second round of loop development that's done to all these things that basically tailors them to every shot. And it really is, every shot is completely specifically tailored.
So I'm assuming that the process for it, apart from things like obviously tracking the camera to get it in the shot, is that there's effectively character animation done, which is then treated with particle effects and or glow effects. Is that the sort of formula?
Yeah, so it's a sort of multi-stage thing. We need to show Tim Burke, and he needs to present to the director two things. We need to sort of sell an aesthetic. So we have to present concept frames, and often we'll go in and the first thing we'll do to try and get a good looking picture, a strong looking image, is to just paint pictures and do concepts on a steel frame, sell the idea, the colors we're going to use, the type and the structure of the magic that we're going to try and achieve. At the same time, we'll always be running quick animatics and play blasted tests that will just be blockouts, really, of the spells and the timings to give a vague sense of the size of the explosion, the positions where it's happening, whether we've got 15 explosions or just a single one, the directions they're coming from. and we'll only really at that point try and vaguely achieve the sort of actual eventual feeling of the movie. So we'll make the spell be a blue ball in the middle of the frame that will sort of appear and disappear at the right time, and the Death Eaters will be a vague black trail in the sky. We're sort of so that the creative people can sit down and decide whether the timings are working and whether there needs to be more spells or less spells. And this also feeds back into their editorial department as well, so that they can begin to refine their cuts and see whether they need to add shots or take shots away. The next stage then for us will be to take one of those shots as a sort of hero, and we will then look, develop it, and put it into pretty much full production. So we'll do all of the effects work for real. We'll be doing high-resolution fluid sims and rendering them out so that our compositing team can essentially try and present Tim and the director with a fully finished version of a shot, at which point they can then see their cut for the timings, they can see the eventual look of one of the shots, and they can try and begin to imagine how the entire scene will play out. Often for temp screenings, we'll leave very rough versions of shots in place. It will be these animatic versions of the shots, because we don't have time to commit resource to producing fully-fledged shots. But it doesn't drag you out of the movie. You can watch the cut and understand what's going on. So we always have multiple versions of shots running at the same time to try and do different jobs for editorial departments, for the director, and for our own internal development as well.
And can we just discuss, the Patronus is at one end of that spectrum. I think the thing that the operations, the particle work, has really given a lot of presence, a lot of signature, I guess, to a lot of the stuff that happens, and obviously tends to be a bunch more punchier because it's almost quite a, well, it's definitely disruptive, but it's almost kind of a vicious kind of way to move around, it seems.
Yeah.
Are those like particle sims that you're running through your own stuff? Is that Krakatoa? How's that working?
We've got a really, really interesting range of software to run all this stuff through, actually. So I would say, just to break it down to fairly simple terms, there are three main components to the, let's say, an explosion inside of a Lovegood house. The first would be a rigid body sim, which we do with a piece of software we've got called Dynamite.
Yep.
And that would be essentially shattering the bricks in the side of the house, and then we will take a wrecking ball, and put it on the end of a big chain in Maya, and we'll drop the wrecking ball at it, and we'll simulate the exact specifics of the spell we're expecting. If we have essentially a magical cannonball hitting the side of the house, we'll fire a cannonball at the side of the house. The software is fantastic because it allows us to input the material properties of an iron cannonball, so it will react with the bricks of the wall in a very realistic way.
Because can I just touch on that? Because a lot of people, when they're doing destruction sequences like that, will do pre-breaks because you get what you sort of want out of it. But this is much more simulation-based than that.
Yeah, it is. I mean, the brickwork of the house has to be sort of pre-shattered a little bit, as it were. But what we'd probably do is, the Lovegood house was this sort of dry stone wall slate construction, which was plastered in a sort of fairly almost wattle and daub-esque material and then painted black. We'll have more than one model of the house. The first version would be essentially what we use for rendering, and it would be, I mean, it's more complicated than this, but it's essentially an extruded cylinder with a displacement map and a texture paint to allow us to make the profile of the house that you can see in the movie. When we come to actually do the destruction model, we would go in and the way I always prefer to do this stuff is to start with the most realistic approach as possible. So we'll go in and we'll build the house with every single brick that is used to construct the house. We'll put in wooden lintels that represent the sides of the windows and the sort of stone windowsill of the bottom of the house. And we'll actually try and make it with the components that go towards constructing this real piece of architecture. We'll also then even go as far as covering the outside with it will be another solid sheet of essentially plaster, which we will allow to crumble during the simulation. And then what we'll do is we'll actually go in and fire this physical magical cannonball at the wall and just let it explode, see what happens. Sometimes you get the most fantastic result in the world. You literally strike gold and you get this beautiful looking simulation. It looks real, it feels real, you've simulated gravity as you expect it to be. Other times it just looks terrible, and you then go back in and you have to try and force the sim to do what you want. So you might start physically describing the shape and size of the hole that you want to destroy by gluing all of the bricks around the outside of the hole together, so that when the cannonball slams into the side, they have no chance of exploding. And I suppose this is probably a fairly similar approach to the way that the SFX guys work on set. They probably run test after test after test of just blowing things up, and sometimes it looks great. Other times they realize they need to glue half the pieces to the floor so that everything doesn't fly off and it starts to become a little rigged, I suppose.
But when you then add to that, because that does look very real, and at this point we could be talking about a sequence from one of Dean Egg's other films that's obviously much more based in a narrative or even historical accuracy. But things like the Death Eaters and the magic that is happening around that is quite often a particle-based effect that A, doesn't respond well to those laws of physics because, frankly, they're flying. B, they have this kind of signature kind of wispiness to them. Is that still sim-based or is it procedural?
Yeah, it is. Right. Death Eaters are a really, really difficult thing to achieve, mostly because of the brief. Well, it's just a difficult brief. You're right in that it's supposed to look like real smoke, but it's inky, dark, black, visceral smoke, almost pyroclastic in places. The idea is that these trails, this smoky trail, can maintain a fairly cohesive form and fly through the air at essentially speeds of up to 90 miles an hour. And again, all of these things are simulated in the computer at the real speeds and the real sizes to get them to work correctly. It has to maintain its cohesive shape, fly through the air at 90 miles an hour, and still look like smoke. And we all know that there is no way that you can make smoke stay in a cylinder and fly through the air at that speed. So we have tips and tricks that we use to try and force this to happen. And what you'll find in, if you look at a piece of Death Eater smoke, that the front end of the smoke is it looks much more like a sort of ink in water feel to it. It has a much more cohesive look. And that, basically, we will run sims that vary the properties of the smoke along the length of the trail. You'll see at the back end of the smoke, the smoke diffuses a lot more readily and reacts to the air and often drifts and sort of wisps away in the air. The hardest thing for the sim guys is forcing this stuff to do stuff. The simulation packages we have are all designed to work under real-world forces, under real-world sort of drag effects and air effects and turbulence fields. So when you try and do something that is unnatural, it tends to break.
Yeah, and also it seems now it's incredibly hard to judge this without the ability to have some kind of Blu-ray disc version that I could pause a frame on. I was watching it in IMAX. But it seemed that you were... Well, some interesting shadowing in the particle streams, for a better term of self-shadowing, though it almost seemed like you'd wound it up to 11. Also, there was, I believe, all these particle things are also casting shadows over the geometry. Is that right?
Yeah, so we will run... Often, this is just a simple 2D cheat to sort of throw shadows on the ground around. And one of the ideas with the Death Eaters is that they sort of absorb light. They have this malevolent presence, and part of the way that we sell that idea in the comps is to allow them to cast a greater shadow than smoke like that actually would. So as they pass over the frame, the light, almost like the lights dim. I know you can see that in the Wedding Attack, that the lights actually do physically dim when the Death Eaters enter. So all the table lamps around just sort of dim in the light. It's like a sort of evil... It's a fairly cheap trick, I suppose, but it has quite a good effect. But then inside the actual smoke itself, there are multiple sets of cloth simulations which we have deliberately rendered and designed to try and blend as carefully into the smoke as possible. But if you look at it, I mean, maybe you're right, you have to get the Blu-ray and pause it, freeze frame through. But you can see all these very thin, almost spaghetti-like threads that are braiding through the length of the smoke from the head into the tail. And then if you get close to the head of the smoke, there are thicker black ribbon-like structures, again, which are sort of plaiting and braiding their way through the tendrils of the smoke. These sort of fairly intestinal-like smoky tendrils have got these very beautiful ribbons that are braiding through them. What that does is... It's firstly, we're trying to suggest this idea that there are creatures inside the smoke, that it's not just a tube of smoke like you see in Lost, but there is a physical presence at the head that is driving the smoke. And the smoke is almost like the disguise that the Death Eaters use whilst they're in the air to hide them.
They are coming. They are coming.
Nobody else is going to die. Not for me.
We have to do something.
You think I don't know how this feels?
You don't know how it feels!
And from a technical point of view, normally there's... And there are a lot of similarities, of course, but there's like cloth sims and there are water sims. And, of course, water sims become most often smoke sims. But they aren't normally a unified world of simulation. They're actually approached from slightly different mathematical points of view. Is Dineg's approach, is there a seamless technical algorithmic base that gets me from cloth all the way through to water, or are you also coming at it from two points of view?
No, we have historically used different packages and different software packages. So on previous movies, we've used Houdini to do cloth, and we've used our in-house fluid solver Squirt to do the fluids. But in here, we still do have done that to the same effect on this movie. But actually, what we've got the ability to do now as well is to use Maya to run the cloth sims, do Zencloth, for example. The fields and forces that we generate to use on the cloth can actually then be set up and run directly through particle caches and also fluid caches as well. So we can use the same fields to drive everything. We can use our fluid and fluid simulations to drive additional particle simulations. So all the turbulences created by the fluids would affect small-scale particulates. So we can add a sort of a slightly grittier feel to parts of the smoke, because often you find that fluid sims for smoke end up looking very soft and flat and sort of cotton woolly, and you don't get that sort of flaky, gritty edge to it. That sort of almost like bonfire smoke has these little particles inside it, and it is a grittier feel. So we try and make it feel more smoky by using these particles rather than steamy, which is it tended to look steamy without the gritty addition. But yes, to answer your question, we can run all our fluids and cloth and particles through similar sets of fields to get them to run and live in the same world and react in the same way.
So does that mean that you're working on vector field type approaches as opposed to like a hybrid or fully particle approach? Because obviously the sims can be one of those three. You know, you can approach things all from a fully particle based system, but obviously lots of people approach them from a combined particle and you know, Mac and Mac grid and stuff.
Yeah, I think it's again, we end up with a mixture of approaches all the time. And again, one of the big things with the Death Eaters is that no two shots are the same. What looks great in one shot just falls down completely flat and doesn't work in another. So, you know, the best way to approach these things is to allow the artists to be flexible enough to use every type of setup possible. So it's always both is the answer, I suppose.
Yeah, because I mean, there is there's such lovely sort of vortexing kind of feelings to some of these movements that don't look like you could animate them, but obviously would want the ability, I presume, for an animator to control them, or at least to activate them.
Yeah, and I mean, it's interesting because this sort of goes back to where we were when we were talking about just blocking out. With the Death Eaters, we have a simple humanoid sort of character rig that lives at the head of the tail, the head of the trail, and he, for previous purposes, just spits out a load of semi-transparent squares behind him, which essentially build up and look like a very low-resolution sort of smoke. Mm-hmm. So one of the things we always encourage the animators to do is, A, don't make it go 200 miles an hour because the sims won't work, but B, to actually pose the character interestingly and to make it fly through the air as if it was a physical object. So when it swoops down and banks, you know, we get the body and the Death Eater to roll, and occasionally you'll put a full 360 degree barrel roll into the Death Eater at the head of the tail, because what that does is sends in the sim, if you're emitting from parts of this rigid body of the Death Eater at the head of the trail, the barrel roll puts beautiful turbulences through the trail and actually adds to the sim, and it means you don't end up forcing sort of unnatural fields into the back of the trail to get pretty shapes. On previous movies, we've gone as far as fully animating a Death Eater flying through the air or landing on the ground, doing a complete cloth simulation on that rigid digital double cache, and then driving fluid sims off of the cloth simulations. Because what you get is, so a Death Eater might land on the ground and the tails of his cloak whip up in the air, and then you'd never see that. But what you would get at the end is a beautiful fluid sim that you'd see all of the curls and whips and licks and flicks of the cloth in the simulation itself. So it goes back to, let's not try and invent this, let's not try and make up how the smoke of a Death Eater should look, but let's think about the logic that goes into it, if you can think of it that way. If there's a man at the front of the trail,
we've talked about, you know, the building collapsing, and we've talked about particles and stuff happening all this kind of environment, which gives the impression that you've got a fully synthetic environment to a certain extent. But of course, the party crashing sequence at the beginning of the film, the collision objects of the party goers themselves, as much as the tables and stuff on the part, really affects everything that's going on there. And as you've got these Death Eaters sort of flying literally from left to right or right to left across frame at the beginning of that attack, did you I don't know, LIDAR scan the tent? Did you just have to build up fake geometry for everything?
Oh, the guys on the Warner Brothers guys are great. They'll scan all of their sets, which is always fantastic. And then, stage one of our setup is to get those scans in. And if they're, we'll build proxy sets based on the scan geometry. So we've got nice, clean, low-resolution geometry. That then goes into the matching we've seen. So, anyone that picks up a scene file nowadays and wants to animate a Death Eater into it or start doing particles will have at least a basic set of geometry in there to, force turbulences into wind or to allow collisions to start happening. So, yes, all of that stuff, I suppose.
Yeah, because that was a very, in one sense, you'd say, it's a simple set, like they're inside a tent. But in another sense, actually, the amount of objects and the kind of close quarter interaction that was going on between the Death Eaters, and I mean, they were quick shots, but nevertheless, there's some really nice stuff going on there. Not that far from the lens, really, as the characters are escaping.
Yeah, it got very close. And that, again, becomes part of the problem, is just trying to force the resolution into the fluid sims that you're creating, to get the sort of number of voxels when you've got something that's that close to screen, which is filling the frame. And you can imagine it's actually quite a deep effect as well. You just have a sort of huge megavoxels worth of fluid sims. Three or four years ago, people started sweating when you said 6 megavoxels. But now the guys are just pushing it higher and higher and higher and higher, and the computers are faster, so it all works, I suppose. Always going back to this idea that if you're trying to make something look real and believable, and you're looking at versions of it in shot, personally for me, if I'm sitting there looking at a version of a shot and trying to work out why it doesn't look good, it's very easy to choreograph something to make it look good in the frame, and you can do that. But then the second problem is, once it looks good, you've got to make it look real, is just sort of think about it in real terms, and what are the forces that interact with it.
I have tremendous sympathy for you in terms of scheduling and bidding, because if we think about what we've been discussing this afternoon, you basically got a bullet type magic effect, which is basically like a flash and some destruction and stuff, which could be, practical on set with wind machine-y type sort of motivated stuff, could be whole buildings going apart. And then at the other sense, you could have the same kind of throws magical, cast magic in this general direction, and that sequence runs for literally seconds of screen time in excruciating close-up with the audience really needing to actually understand as a significant plot point what that character's Patronus is, and that will play out in another film, and it's all very important. I mean, how the heck you bid that so that you balance between that 3 second and the 3 frame, I have no idea.
Yeah, the big thing, I mean, often, add extra seconds, it's gonna take longer anyway, but as soon as you get into storytelling, then you know that the director is really the only person, and Tim Burke as well, obviously, they're really the only people that are going to be able to tell you that your storytelling is doing the right thing. And so you sort of get a bit of a second sense for these shots. You can see them coming a mile off. You know it's going to be tricky. We've done it on the previous movies as well, and, maybe the first time we did it, we got caught out, and there are some shots that really took us a lot longer than we expected. But you do begin to get a bit of a sense for it, and you see the hard ones coming, and you just allow the right amount of time and resources to do the work.
The other thing that I was going to mention, and I just touched on then, obviously practical stuff on set, is that depending on the duration and the nature of these shots, really depends on the contact lighting that you would want on the principal cast. And so, for example, if Harry fires something and it's of any duration, we'd expect Harry to be lit up by the light that's coming from that effect.
Yeah.
Are you introducing that in post, or is that nearly always dictated to by the beats of what physical lighting were cast on the actor on set as part of the contact lighting that was filmed?
I think there's usually a fairly obvious split there. Big storytelling moments, they would do on-set lighting. So the Patronus itself, they had a huge, well, it wasn't huge, it was about a foot square sort of cube of LEDs, which is just spitting blue light out all over the frame. So they'll do it in camera. You know, they might end up pulsing the light a little bit more than you'd wanted to, and you have to sort of average that out and try and get the luminance a bit more stable across the shot. But it's there. They would see that coming and never expect you to try and repaint the lighting on 20 people inside a wedding tent. The spells, though, the flip side of that is they don't want to sort of commit to timings of spells on individual shots whilst they're filming when they don't know how they're going to cut the edit up. And they might shoot a shot for 12 seconds with three flashes of magic in and then realize that they used 2 seconds where there are no flashes. So what they'll do is they won't do any interactive lighting for magical spells usually. And because it's just a frame here and a frame there, we'll just sort of gently paint the plate a little bit, introduce a little bit of color. Often using the light that's already in the frame sympathetically and regrading it just gently to sort of introduce the colors of the spells. So you don't push it too far again. So you're not trying to depart too far from the photography.
Well, luckily from you guys in the next film, obviously there's not going to be much spell casting or rapid fire spell, so that'll make life a lot easier come the finale of that.
Yeah, there'll just be a lot of destruction, I'm sure.
Yeah, no, there's going to be quite a lot of work in that last film. And look, I really appreciate you taking time to talk to us because, as I say, a lot of these things, it's easy to go past. And I've got to say, I think I've said it before, the effects animators and the guys that do these kind of jobs probably don't get enough attention for the terrific work they do. And so thank you for talking about it.
Yeah, that's cool. It's really good. It's really interesting to talk about it, actually. And you're right. I don't think people realize how long those sims take.
Yeah.
And how many hours those guys spend just perfecting their art, really. It's an incredible service they do.
Yeah, and the trouble with a sim is that it's everything you want it to be when it does exactly what you want it to be. But of course, if you're trying to simulate something in much the same way, as I think you alluded to with miniatures before, if you sort of don't happen to get it right, you just simulate something you don't want. And
that's the problem. Is sims are so intelligent and they do things so cleverly, but they're so unmanageable and undirectable. It's the worst thing in the world, really, to produce a sim and find that it's too slow, or find that you've done it all to perfect sort of real world scale and space and gravities, but then the whole thing just looks wrong and it's too slow because it's really difficult to direct simulation.
Yeah,
it's really difficult to say, I'd love this smoke, but can you make it go left and then right and then back? I mean, you can blow the smoke with the wind, but to then sometimes the direction is so specific that it actually becomes really difficult trying to fill a glass jar with smoke, take the jar away and have the smoke still stay in the same shape as the jar is a very difficult thing to try and do. And you know, we often get asked to do much harder things than that.
David, if you'll indulge me to tell you a story I once heard somebody recount, which I've always stuck with me in terms of simulations, and I apologise, but it's quite, I think, illuminating. Somebody I once remember hearing in the early days of Sims was asked to come and simulate a whole lot of flags because they had shot a whole lot of flags on flagpoles, and they were all wrapping around the flagpoles and not hanging out the side looking good. And, of course, you know how this is going to end. They simulated it perfectly, and they did these big Sims of the cloth on the flagpole, and guess what? All the Sims wrapped around the flagpole and didn't stick out. And I'm always reminded of that story when we talk about Sims because it's this thing that, you know, you say, oh, I want to simulate it, and you go, okay, well, if you simulate it, it would all disperse and you wouldn't see anything. Oh, okay, well.
This is a brilliant example, and I've done the exact same thing myself. When I was working on Children of Men, and we had a shot where Clive Owen's in a posh car, and he's traveling down the Mall, and he goes through Admiralty Arch, and you look up and above and behind him, and there is a huge array of naval ensign flags hanging above, and I think they'd gone out and filmed it, and it was they'd all got a bit tied up, and they just sort of hang limply in the breeze and twisted around each other. And they went, "Oh, this isn't very good. Let's just replace them with CG." So I picked the scene up and run a sim, and they pretty much just hang really limply and tied each other up in knots and look just as boring. And they're like, "We didn't want you to just replace what was in the set. We want to do good flags that present themselves beautifully to camera and ruffle gently in the breeze." And so I spent the next 4 months trying to fix them.
Yeah, the idea that a sim is a solution, it is a solution, obviously it's a great solution, but it isn't a solution that intuitively knows what the director wants.
That's the problem, isn't it? Sometimes they don't want what's real and what's right, and that's why they're making movies, and that's why, you know, they have the vision, and that's why we do it in the computer, because it doesn't have to be real. Otherwise, they just would have hung the flags up and shot it for themselves.
Though in your case, yes, the added dimension that that we all know what a Death Eater is meant to look like while flying at 90 miles an hour with smoke. Having said that, it's impossible. Yeah, so there you go.
Yeah, that's where it does get a little difficult, because actually it's really impossible to go out and find the reference of what that would look like. So it becomes an interpretation. It becomes everybody has their own interpretation of what they expect it to look like. And depending on what they've seen recently, it will be different. So
yeah.
In those instances, what what I try and do, or what we all try and do, is make the best looking thing we can. Try and answer the brief. Make a really good looking creative picture that everyone can go, "Yeah, that's brilliant. That looks good." And then you just hope that because it looks great and because it works, that they like it too. You know, we're paid to come up with the answers, and often that's the fun thing, is that we get a brief and then we provide our creative interpretation of it, and that's how we contribute to the films. That's the exciting stuff.
Well, look, thank you so much, because I certainly enjoyed spending a bit of time with the boys and girls outside Hogwarts, and I particularly enjoyed the work of your effects team on making them nearly kill each other. So thanks so much.
You're welcome. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you much. Bye.
Thanks very much for David Vickery for sitting down with us and talking to us about this film. I just wanted to say a quick aside. I'm down in Adelaide visiting a friend at Rising Sun Pictures this week, and saw the movie down here. And I've got to say that I sat waiting anxiously for the visual effects credits and was just saddened by the placement of the credits in this film. This is obviously a film that would not exist without visual effects, that just couldn't be told, and yet visual effects credits were literally this time all the way down by the copyright. I mean, just the very last possible credit you could possibly get. And I don't know what we have to do to change that, but it's just embarrassing for the industry, for the visual effects industry, that this continues, that a film like this with so many people working so hard, and obviously production side, a lot of people too, but for visual effects to be relegated to this bottom of the credits position, just blatantly, it just really bothered me. So I don't know what we can do about that, but I thought I'd bring it up. Anyway, really enjoyed this podcast, and looking forward to the next one, which we'll bring you very shortly. For my partners, Mike Seymour and John Montgomery, this is Jeff Huser. See you on the next FX Podcast.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.